This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influenced their work. My guest today is director, writer, and cinematographer Cary Fukunaga. Fukunaga produced and directed season one of HBO's moody, unsettling, and highly successful crime drama, True Detective, set in and around New Orleans. He has three feature films under his belt as well, shot in Mexico, England, and Ghana. For Cary Fukunaga, each production is as unique as the shooting location itself.
Every movie so far has been so different in that sense, in the same way like every relationship is different. There are general things that are the same, you know, film to film, but my first movie was such bliss in terms of the general passion of the crew and how much everyone sort of filled in the gaps
for Sin Nombre.
For Sin Nombre, yeah. And then Jane Eyre was like, you know, it was like a mercenary army where at 11 hours and 59 minutes, people were ready to pull the plug and go home. It took me about half of that film to win over the crew. And I think it was necessary. I think you need the crew on your side. So yes, there's a level of it, but that's also why you start surrounding yourselves with the same heads of department so that you don't have to win them over. They get it, and then their sort of loyalty and
They're your people.
They're your people, and their loyalty and enthusiasm sort of trickles down.
The Sin Nombre, was that a short film that was made into a studio film, correct, or a feature film? Right?
Yeah, the short was a slightly different story, but same world. It was about a truckload of immigrants that were abandoned in South Texas, and it was in a refrigerated trailer. So a lot of them suffocated to death, very similar to what happened just last summer in Austria.
You went to NYU Film School?
Yeah, grad film.
And you went to grad film. Where did you go undergrad?
I went to Santa Cruz.
For?
History and a little bit of political science. I went for a year to a political science institute in Grenoble, France.
And you grew up in Northern California?
Yeah, I'm from the East Bay, but I've lived all around the Bay Area, moved every couple of years. So I did a kind of a ring around the Bay Area. But then when I go home now, I go home to Oakland.
And your father or both your parents were born in an internment camp, or one of them was?
My dad was.
He was born in an internment camp.
He and my uncles are born. He was born in Topaz. My uncles were born in Tule Lake because my family were no-nos, which means they signed no to two questions that the U.S. government posed all Japanese Americans put in these camps. One was, do you forswear citizenship or allegiance to your birth country or your country of your race, which is Japan? And then the second question is, will you fight in the U.S. military? And if you answer no to both those questions, you were sent to this other camp, which was sort of under martial law the entire war.
That's where your father was?
Yeah.
Does he talk much about that, or has he?
I think he was like three when he left, and then the Japanese were moved to a sort of ghetto, if you will, in Richmond in the Bay Area. And from there, they sort of worked and moved out within the next couple of years.
Your mother's not Japanese.
No. So she's, you know, middle American, Swedish heritage, you know.
You're Japanese and Swedish.
Basically, yeah.
That's great. Describe to me, when you do a film and you come in there, what you feel the job is. What is the task?
I had a conversation with Alfonso Cuarón right before I went into Jane Eyre. And it was the first time I would be directing a screenplay that I didn't write myself. And he said something really simple but very important, which was your job as a director is not to just illustrate somebody's screenplay. Your job is to make it something entirely different. And I think it's just really good advice because I think many people are very precious about writing. Writing is essential, especially for dialogue and general story and plot. But the screenplay in terms of cinema and movie making is really just a starting point. It's a floor plan where the finishing work is going to come, you know, much later. So I look at it as trying to figure out what my unified vision is going to be, what the overall emotional impact of the story is, and what state I want the audiences to be in when they're done.
So when you go from Sin Nombre to you're on the set directing Judi Dench, how did that feel?
I was very aware that she had already at that point had done more movies than I will ever do in three of my lives.
So, was she kind to you?
Super kind. Right. She doesn't mind direction. She likes direction and wants to make the director happy. And that made it a lot easier because at first I wasn't sure what I could say to her. Prior to that, I'd really only been directing non-professional actors.
You graduated from NYU graduate film school when?
Well, technically I haven't graduated yet.
But you attended there when?
2002 to 4 or 5.
And when you had left Santa Cruz with your, did you get a degree in history?
Yeah.
When you left, I wasn't sure if you didn't finish there either. When you left, I don't want to assume anything now. But when you left Santa Cruz with a degree in history and you went to NYU, how did that happen? Meaning, what made you want to go to a graduate film program?
Well, I think I'd wanted to do movies for a long time. Started writing my first shorts when I was like 10. Wrote my first.
So you had the bug before?
I had the bug before and, you know, saved up when I was 14 to buy a video camera. Would write stories. And then in college, I think I decided to pursue snowboarding and sports as a career and potentially, you know, be a professional snowboarder. And by the time I was 20, 21, I was starting to realize that might be a really impossible dream at that point. Usually, if you're not like on the A-team by age 17 or 18, you're never going to catch up. So I started to write stories again. I thought about getting a double major at Santa Cruz in film, and I went and talked to the head of the department. And he made it seem like I'd have to be there 2 more years to study film, and I wasn't going to stay in Santa Cruz. So I traveled for a bit, and then I went down to L.A. and started crewing.
What was the first movie you crewed on?
The first big production. I did a couple of indies around the Bay Area, but the first production I showed up on in Los Angeles was a pickup shoot for a Destiny's Child Survivor out of Zuma Beach. It was amazing. I mean, like, I didn't have to pick up cigarette butts. I had a pretty cool job. I was on the camera truck, and so I was right up there with the cinematographer and watching, Beyonce do her thing.
It was a video?
It was a video, I mainly worked on music videos and commercials out there.
Any features?
Like, some indie features that I don't think ever went anywhere.
Now, why NYU? I mean, as a native of California, even North, which I'm always mystified when natives of Central or Northern California leave because it's so beautiful there. I mean, LA, I can see you wanting to get out of there because it's so crowded. But the why NYU?
I think, especially if you're from the East Bay, like Oakland and Berkeley, Brooklyn is very analogous as cities and the multicultural side.
You want to cross
a
bridge to go home.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or not.
Or also, I mean, you just want to be in a place, there's an urban side to the Bay Area that you, like, even with San Francisco being a very small, big city, but still a big city that I grew up with that Los Angeles didn't have. And I think also when you grow up in Northern California, you grow up with a sort of natural antagonism for the Southern California that most Southern Californians aren't even aware of. So it's like when you're in college for the first time together, the Southern Californians had no idea that Northern Californians didn't like them. And the Northern Californians were like, we have no reason not to like them, except we were just raised to not like the South for some reason.
It's like in New York. We have an upstate, downstate thing here, too. So you come here. Did you take to New York? Where do you live now?
I live in the West Village.
You do? So you like New York. You took to it.
I've been here for almost 15 years, so yeah, I've taken to it.
And when you finished the NYU graduate program, and according to your, you just press... click on the internet or where your career took you. There's a lot of time in between Sin Nombre and when you left the graduate film program, correct?
It seems like it, but if you think about the chronology, so my short was at, I shot the short at the end of 2003. I finished it by the summer of 2004. It was at Sundance in 2005. Then I was at the Sundance Writing Lab in 2006. Was making it in 2007. 2008 did post. 2009 it came out. So it seems... 4 years go by.
You squeezed the hell out of that Sin Nombre experience, obviously. You wrote that thing for 5 years.
It was the college.
Writing labs.
Yeah.
So when you're done with that, Sin Nombre's done, what year?
I finally finished it in 2008, but it didn't come out until 2009.
The next thing for you was Jane Eyre in 2011, correct?
Yep.
And what do you think it was that they hired you for to do that movie?
Well, actually, it was—
Did they convey that to you?
It wasn't really happening. It had been sitting on a shelf at the BBC for a while. And I had a general meeting with the BBC executive, and I just asked what they had. And Jane Eyre was a project I was actually thinking about adapting while I was waiting for Sin Nombre to get the green light. So I had this 6 months off, you know, between thinking we're making it and then having it pushed for like 8 months. And I just wrote Beast of No Nation at that time period. And
by yourself?
Yeah. Yeah.
All by yourself?
I adapted the novel at the end of 2006 and basically was thinking about, well, what else can I write while I'm waiting? I wanted to stay busy. And Jane Eyre was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid because my mom liked the old black and white classics. So Bob Stevens' version with Joan Fontaine and Orson Welles was like one of my childhood favorites. And I thought about adapting it and updating it. had no idea there were so many other adaptations out there. Zero. When I sought it out at the BBC, I still didn't know. It wasn't until I had signed on.
There are more Jane Eyres than there are Frankensteins out there.
Basically, yeah. And so, or Spider-Mans or He-Mans, the Hulks. So I was unaware of them. And then when I found out there were so many, I just consciously ignored them. But I sort of was the one that pulled it off the shelf again and brought it to Focus Features. So it wasn't like they solicited me. I actually asked to read it, and then I met with Alison Owen, the producer. She asked what I would change in the screenplay, and I told her the things I wanted to change, but essentially I felt it was pretty good, I thought.
But why that? Why did you want to do that?
I wanted to do a period piece. I was a history major. I love history. One day I want to do giant epics, you know, a la Lawrence of Arabia. So yeah, so the Jane Eyre for me was a primer. It was a way to show that I could do a period film, a classic film. Seeing Normandy in many ways was still like my short film from college, and I believe in sort of studying classics before branching out and experimenting. And I thought doing—
What did you learn on Jane Eyre? What was the learning curve for you on the production?
I think
about acting, about cinematics, anything?
All those things, because what I learned about was stillness. Like, so much of contemporary cinema is filled with showmanship and pizzazz and using visuals to hide for a lack of storytelling. And what I wanted to learn about was doing as little as possible and try to tell a compelling story.
In terms of the camera?
In terms of camera, in terms of even, Charlotte Bronte in particular, wrote really extensive dialogue scenes. And as a director, in a great dialogue scene, you're just there to observe because the actors are the ones doing all the work. You know, they're all the dramatic fireworks are coming from them. And there's an impulse to try to do something because you're not really doing anything there. You're not moving the camera. You're not really able to shape that in any other way or manipulate it, maybe is a better word. And what I learned there, and I talked to Alison Owen about it while we were shooting, I was just like, I don't feel like I'm doing anything all day. and she's like, it's fine. It's okay.
It's funny you say that because one of the first movies I made was Beetlejuice. And there was a woman named Linda Henriksen who was my customer on the film. And they had summoned some of the people in to come look at the dailies the first couple of days to see how their stuff was looking on film. And I said, how did it look? I never wouldn't go to the dailies because I found it very unsettling. I said, how did Gina look? I said, because when I work with Gina, she does almost nothing. It's almost as if you wonder, they say action, and you wonder, did she even hear them say action? And Linda said to me, oh, my God. He said, she's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, because 40 feet across and 20 feet high, the slightest little thing. It was just, she said, she's so entertaining and you can't take her eyes off. You can't take your eyes off her.
Yeah, and that's I think both Fassbender and Mia brought a lot of that, you know.
Stillness.
And you oftentimes can't see it even on the monitors when you're watching because of these tiny screens. But as soon as you start projecting that stuff, especially Mia's performance, there's just the veins in her neck and little things in her and adjustments in her face or in her eyes that are coming from some central emotional place were so powerful. And that wasn't me. That was her, you know.
So when you come out of that, you're a history major from Santa Cruz and you come out of that and you make this film, this Bronte novel. And what's the next thing for you?
True Detective.
I mean, the first thing I thought to myself when I saw that and I hadn't met you with, because the show, for people who don't know, and there are very few people who don't know, the show, it was 10 episodes this season, the first season. And the first season was written by?
Nick Pizzolatto.
Right. So Nick Pizzolatto wrote the first season and you directed how many of the 10 episodes?
It was 8 episodes and I directed all 8.
So season one was 8 episodes.
Right.
And you did all 8.
Right.
And so did you know that going in? Did they say to you from the get-go, we want you to come and do all 8 episodes of the show? Or did you do a couple and they went, wow, we really like him. We want you to stay?
The idea, so I was there as part of the pitch. And the idea was it was going to be like an anthology. And every year they'd bring in.
Well, you were there as part of the pitch. How?
We packaged it within anonymous content. Nick is a writer there. I'm a director, writer
and what
there.
And what made them want the guy from Jane Eyre to come do the searing, violent, blood-spattered, insane. What did you think they saw in you?
I actually have never asked them that question. I should sit down with Steve Gollan and ask him.
Never occurred to you?
Never occurred to me. I was just, we had conversations about it, had ideas. I knew sort of how I'd want to treat it. I loved the idea of sort of a neo-noir. I was more than anything, I was excited about genre shifting again. And not staying in
the
same world.
Who cast the show? Was it HBO? I mean, because HBO is very hands-on.
Yeah. Well, you mean just in terms of bringing in Matthew and Woody?
Right.
Well, what happened there was—
I'm sure you could have had your pick of a lot of actors.
It was actually a really good time because that was right after Jane Eyre had come out. And basically, same with Jane Eyre, like Fassbender and Mia were my first choices. So I just had conversations with them, you know, and then through the conversations, they signed on. Same thing with Dame Judy. Everyone said, you're not going to get Judy to be in this. And I wrote her just a little note and just sort of—
You're very lucky.
I'm very lucky.
Incredibly lucky.
I'm aware of this, by the way.
You're good, but you're lucky and good. But so any time I saw a man with a beard who seemed like that kind of crispy biker gang crowd that McConaughey goes back to get high and reconnect with and prove himself with by getting like super stoned, those are some of the best stoned scenes I've ever seen in my life, ever. I mean, I was getting a contact high just watching it. And then every time I saw a guy with a beard, I wanted to run up and break a chair over his face or run in the opposite direction crying. Like, you put the fear of God in me by the madness and the real interiority of those guys.
I don't know how I did it.
How did you do that?
I don't know. I mean, I was trying to – I was wondering if you're going there. And I think about that, you know, if you
emotionally too.
Well, I try to think about the movies we watch, say an action film, right, where it's filled with all these sort of big set pieces, and the body count is extremely high. And why is it we can watch that and laugh and eat our popcorn? It doesn't really affect us. But then a movie with like where one person's killed can just, you know, we can't shake the image. I try to think about that in terms of like what I'm going for execution in terms of the mood or tone of a scene or even the impact of something violent in the story, maybe sometimes just the banality of it, you know, through again, the stillness and not trying to oversell something. It's the seduction of thinking everything's normal when it's not, you know?
What I loved about your show, for the most part, it was numbingly real. Those scenes where McConaughey goes back to that group and tries to befriend those guys and everything that goes on there through the shooting and the killing and the kind of the fusillade that takes place and then they all bolt. The only question I have, so whose idea was it for McConaughey to keep cutting open the soda can all the time?
That was definitely Nick's idea because it was...
Nick's idea. And then I want to register that complaint because I thought if he cuts one more fucking soda can...
Oh, just talk about continuity, man. That was a pain in the ass.
The smoking and the characterization through smoking and cutting the soda can, I thought, okay, we've had just about enough of that right now.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I will say... That also made it so great, other than your work, and I really mean that you did an amazing job, is how much I worship Woody. I'm a complete – you tell me Woody's in the movie, I'm there. I worship Woody.
Some people just have that magic. There's no one else in the world like Woody Harrelson.
There isn't.
There is not. And, you know, that's what he brought to the scenes too. He's like – he's got a special energy. And
he's got everything.
It's and you never know what it's going to be. It's unpredictable. Yeah,
he's masculine.
Yeah,
he's playful. He's intelligent. He's loopy. Did you enjoy working with him?
Yeah, no, I mean he was. I enjoyed not only what he was doing on screen, but just sort of his energy, just on set and around set. Guy.
How long did it take to shoot the 8 episodes? Did they leave you alone? And you had a decent amount of time, or was it tight?
It was pretty tight. It was pretty tight. We were every day. It was pretty stressful. We shot it in 100 days. So what does that work out to? It's a little bit more than 12 days an episode.
Yeah. Where did you shoot?
Louisiana, outside of New Orleans, yeah. Right.
And Pizzolatto wrote all of it?
Yep, wrote the whole thing.
And how much were Woody or McConaughey or you or other people allowed to do some alterations to that, do some alternate takes, alternate lines?
There was definitely, in the shaping of the narrative, there was a lot of collaboration early on. And then I think Woody definitely brought humor into it for both characters and made sure that the interplay between the two guys was more balanced and fair. Earlier drafts, I think, the Cole character, Matthew McConaughey's character, was just sort of just spewing out stuff. And
his wife was played by?
Michelle Monaghan. Monaghan.
And yeah. Michelle Monaghan, I couldn't believe you got Michelle Monaghan to do that sex scene with McConaughey. I was stunned.
Yeah.
Well, I thought, Michelle Monaghan, no, she would never do that. And here she is having a very, you know, like almost hardcore sex scene with him. I thought, my God.
I think we only did one take of that one, too. That was an intense scene.
I certainly
scene.
Hope so.
Yeah, that was a really intense scene. And I was obviously trying to be sensitive to Michelle.
And what was her attitude about doing that? Because it's interesting. In this day and time, I find that women nowadays, it's like, let's not even go there.
It's tough because there was three different girls that had to do sex scenes in this show. And my first movie, there was kind of a sex scene, but I was really uncomfortable. I couldn't even ask the girl to take her top off. You know, right. I just felt really out of place there.
And it's not fun.
It's just it's a strange scene to be a guy with the, if you sit down with her in the makeup trailer and the producer and kind of describe what we're looking for, it definitely has to be character-based. And I think Michelle understood both for the Woody scene when they're in, as a couple married, how they come back together at that point in the dramatic arc of their relationship. The sex scene was important to show that connection, to show it still exists. And then later on, the sex scene with Matthew was sort of essential for understanding the split between them and how she drove it.
But is she down for that, though?
Yeah.
Well, is there some kind of, this is part of directing?
Yeah. Kind of? Well, so Matthew, again, is very planned and he has ideas for things. So, you know, Matthew's like, well, first I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do this.
He choreographs
the whole thing. And
but you have to, basically.
It's like a partner dance. And yeah. Michelle's
there.
That's
Arthur Murray.
And then we pull Michelle aside and like, are you okay with all of these things? And Michelle always had every girl had the cut call. So they know they're allowed to call cut in a situation like that. And they had to feel comfortable to be able to call cut. That's also a big thing. You can say that and then they still feel like,
So did Michelle never call cut or did she call cut 27 times that day?
Well, we only did on the Matthew day, we only did that one take. And on Woody's, I think we did two and she called cut both times.
Fukunaga created an atmosphere on the set of True Detective that allowed his actors to give exceptional performances. Both McConaughey and Harrelson were nominated for a Golden Globe and a Screen Actors Guild Award. Explore the Here's the Thing archives, where I speak to director William Friedkin about his unorthodox casting process.
Roy Scheider, when I cast him, he said, don't you want me to read for this part? I said, there's nothing to read. The guy goes, get your hands up. Get over. What is that? Who wants to listen to that? In a goddamn conference room, you know?
Take a listen at heresthething.org.
Hey, Here's the Thing, listeners. We're hoping to learn more about what you want to hear and how you listen to shows from WNYC Studios. Please visit WNYC.org/participate and take our brief survey. That's WNYC.org/participate. You can also find a link on the episode page for Alex's conversation with Cary Fukunaga. Thanks.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. My guest today is director, writer, and cinematographer Cary Fukunaga. His latest feature film, Beasts of No Nation, depicts the horrors of a civil war in an unnamed West African country. Critically acclaimed for its story, direction, and acting, the film, however, did not get a single Academy Award nomination.
There's a couple things going against us, which was not having a major studio with its sort of locked-in Oscar voters.
Who released the film?
Netflix released the film. Having Netflix as a perceived online-only game player.
People thought it was a TV show.
That was a TV movie. I think subject matter, most people would discover it once all the voting was done. And still a bulk would never see it ever in the future. So I think we thought it was a long shot. Of course,
did Netflix learn a lot from that experience about how they're going to do that differently from now on? I hope so.
We have yet to have a real follow-up conversation. Like,
would you like to?
Yeah, and I have ideas, but they also, you know, the game is changing in terms of how people consume movies. The awards aren't going to immediately reflect that.
They're still going to be looking over here.
You know, I say this with all honesty. This is not out of like, well, I don't care. I actually haven't watched the Academy Awards in over 10 years.
You didn't watch the Academy Awards when I hosted with Steve Martin in 2010. What you meant to say was that in 2010 you made an exception.
Yeah, yeah.
And you watched the one that I hosted.
I watched it pirated on, you know.
Yeah, you watched it on. No, okay.
I stopped watching it around film school because we'd have these kind of these pools to see who'd win the Oscars, and I would always lose the pool. Like I voted.
So you were terrible at it.
I was terrible. I always voted for the films that I thought deserved it, exactly. And clearly that's just not how it works. And that's when I kind of got that sense of it. Then over the years, when I saw the films that were being nominated, I just had zero interest. I really did. Yeah. And but that doesn't mean that when you're not nominated, you're not like, you know, feeling the burn, because it's like not being picked for, you know, the Little League baseball team, and you wonder why.
people who are voting, they have no opportunity. They have no hope of seeing everything that's out there, even everything good. Mm-hmm. People are playing telephone. Somebody calls up somebody and says, what do you like? And there are people who move little bundles of voters in a certain direction. And those people are old guard Hollywood. They're studio Hollywood. And they'll be in touch with people who it's like a chain. And that person then is in touch with people who are costume designers and set designers and do different jobs who haven't made a movie in 25 years. And membership in the Academy is their one lifeline to the industry still that they take very seriously. And that's been a problem for years. And your situation is emblematic of the fact that it's only getting worse, only getting worse.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the reforms they're trying to talk about, I'm not informed enough about how to make it more diverse or make it more reflective of our society and our world now, because there's also a part of any art, any guild that is about protecting the legacy and protecting, you know, the rights of former members of their industry. You know, you can't just strip away membership, but maybe there's another way to weigh it. I don't know. It's just because you want to believe, like, health insurance, you know, or Social Security, that, you know, you've put a lifetime into this industry that, you know, until you die, you'll still be respected.
Yeah. There's an annuity there for you.
Yeah.
You said you wrote the screenplay, you adapted the screenplay for Beasts of No Nation when?
2006.
So you carried it around for a while.
It's been around. Yeah. It's only I didn't rewrite it until about 6 months before we started shooting.
Did True Detective help you get that job?
No. Put that together? No. I actually had the producers and
people
the
were so admiring of the TV show. I wonder if it helped you.
It didn't even help in terms of pre-sales. I had Idris and the show, and that didn't help.
What was the budget, if you don't mind me asking, for the film?
It was $6 million.
And where'd you shoot?
In Ghana, West Africa.
You're not married?
Not married.
You have no kids?
No kids.
So you go to Ghana for how long? You prepped for how long?
I prepped there not long enough. I think we had about 8-9 weeks of prep. I was down for about a week. I had malaria right before we started shooting. I was bedridden. I was able to get some final rewrites done to lock the script before we went into production. But I don't think I could ever do a project like that again. It definitely took a lot out of me.
How did you find your lead actor?
I had a casting director I brought out who is A.V. Kaufman's son, Harrison Nesbitt. He was 23 when he came out there, pretty much fresh out of undergrad. He had helped out on Life of Pi. I knew what I was looking for in terms of street casting. This wasn't something where we were going to be able to, like, make TV and radio announcements and get thousands of kids show up. I mean, we were going to have to go out in the neighborhoods and find these kids. And that's exactly what he did. And he got a small team of Ghanaians together, and they went everywhere.
What's the boy's name again?
Abraham Atta.
Oh, my God. Where's he from?
So he's from a neighborhood called Shimon. That's kind of a poor neighborhood. It's a working neighborhood in Accra. And
had he acted before?
He'd never really acted before. He did a couple of, like, you know, in church, you know, some scenes in church from the Bible.
How did you direct him?
We did a boot camp, if you will, of acting. About 2 weeks before we started shooting, we had about 30 kids who were sort of finalists for all the roles. And we just taught them the basics, you know. This wasn't going to be something where they could just feel it out. Like, they needed some tools.
You didn't have time.
Yeah.
To rely on them.
Yeah. No,
they had to give them some.
I had to give them
instruction.
You know, and exercises too. Like, one of the things we had to kind of pull out of their toolbox was the soap opera style acting that they're used to. A lot of the Nollywood films and the Ghanaian version of Nollywood films are very.
What is Nollywood?
Nigeria style.
Is that what they call Nollywood?
Nollywood, yeah.
That's so funny.
And I mean, they're the most prolific film producing country in the world, I think, even more than India. But there's a style of acting there that's oftentimes very, very big. And this film, we wanted to pull it back. So a lot of it was, rather than indicating an emotion, it was just trying to access a memory to feel it. So much more of a Strasberg thing. And we did 2 weeks of that and tried to work on the different sort of emotional beats he would go through in the movie, and all the kids did it because we had to see who was the one who was best at it. And Abraham just always came at it from a much more a smaller and much more sort of honest perspective. He was from the get-go that wasn't overacting. if anything, I had to pull it more out of him.
So is it safe to say that you had a pool of young boys or
He was 12 when we shot.
You had a pool of kids, let's say, around that age, and you weren't quite sure who would play. The one who would play that lead role would emerge from that pool, correct?
He had to, because at that point, you know, Harrison and Saul were 2,000 kids, and I had seen tape on a couple hundred, and these were the top 30. You know, we weren't going to find them anywhere
else.
How
did the shooting go?
It was hard, because even on the first—
What was hard about?
Everything.
Weather?
Weather. We didn't, you don't even have radar there. You know, like in Louisiana, we get rainstorms all the time, but you could look on the Doppler and see if it's gone in 15 minutes or 4 hours.
Who was your DP?
And make plans. I was the DP. So that wasn't the hard part. I mean, it was physically strenuous. I think the hard part was that we just—
You're Soderbergh.
Never had the money, never had the time. Soderbergh's a much smarter guy than me, so he had that for him.
But he shoots his own stuff.
Yeah. I mean
Soderbergh— You like it?
He's a machine, you know. He can edit when he goes home. Like I'm dead.
Soderbergh is a cyborg. I'm told from people who yeah. He's a cyborg. But I mean, yeah. Why do you you prefer it?
I like shooting. Yeah.
Did you do that in True Detective?
I've always been really involved in camera. It's just one of the things.
Did you operate on True Detective?
I didn't like to operate. I don't want to like get involved in that level. Like I'd rather be able to pay attention to performance and not the frame.
So you didn't operate in Beasts of No Nation?
I wasn't supposed to operate, but our Steadicam operator, who is our A-cam operator. Pulled his hamstring on the very first day, the first setup in the second take. And after that, he couldn't move the camera. So I became—
The NYU degree came in handy.
It came in handy. We do everything there. So.
Who'd have thought?
I was, you know, boom operating sometimes.
Describe your lead actor to me.
Abraham or Idris?
Idris.
Idris. Idris is—
I shouldn't say that, yeah. Idris, I shouldn't say the lead actor, because the other boy, the young boy, he is Abraham. He is every inch the lead actor as well.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
There's no such thing as a big actor or a small actor. It's even Abraham's like 4 feet tall. But Idris is, he's a force of nature.
How did you find him?
I found him through his work, essentially. I was very aware of his work.
You had freedom to cast who you wanted to cast.
You can call it freedom or the limitations of the subject matter.
But nobody gave you shit about we need a name we can raise money off of.
For me, Idris is a name. He's a huge name.
No one came to you and said, well, here's another list.
Oh, right.
Oh, Matthew McConaughey play this role.
Robert Daddy Jr.
Yeah, Robert Daddy Jr., exactly.
He's already done that role. Idris was on a very, very short list of actors, maybe two. And he was my first choice just based on the gravitas, the way you're describing Woody, where he's masculine, you know, he's intelligent, but he's sensitive, all those qualities. He really, and they're all living at the same time in him. It's not like he's like changing colors like a wheel. They all exist, you know, coexist. And I needed someone that could pull off that kind of, I don't want to call it gang leader, but that sort of, town hall charisma, which is different than, say, like a Mugabe.
In the book, he dies.
And in the movie,
how does he die?
He's shot by one of the soldiers in a very similar scene.
In that final encampment when they say goodbye to him?
Yeah.
One of them shoots him?
Yeah.
Does it build to a head where he shoots him? Is he bullying them and he's taking the money and one of them shoots him?
It's basically similar. They're just run down and they have no goal anymore. Everything has sort of been a lie. And then one of the soldiers named Rambo shoots him.
Kid.
He's like a teenager, essentially.
Why didn't you do that?
In my first draft, I had Agu do it because I wanted Agu to take control of his destiny and make a choice and in some way, vengeance for everything he's experienced. And then as I did my rewrite, I thought that was too easy. It was too buttoned up and neat way out of the story. And that life, which I think in the banal sense we were talking about earlier, the more insidiously evil and frightening version is that he still exists out there like a shark in murky water.
Yeah. In my version, he would have, like, something would have happened. I don't know what it would be. I'm not a good writer. He would have tripped and fallen on some Burmese tiger trap. And he begs the kid to kill him, put him out of his misery. Because it was one of those characters where, I mean, because that sex scene with him and the boy is so subtle and so quiet. And he's, you know, he's obviously he's high and he's kind of blitzed out the character. And when that happens, everyone I was in the room with, we were all like, oh, I hope this guy dies.
In the screenplay, there wasn't much more. There's a couple more lines in there that kind of make it even more uncomfortable. And Idris was kind of, he was the one, in almost the, we were talking earlier about sex scenes. He was the one who's like, I'm not comfortable going that far. I just can't do that. He, you know, newborn child, he's got a daughter, young daughter. He's like, that's just something I'm just, I can't.
Yeah, you don't want to go there.
I can't go there.
What are you working on now?
I am working on a mini series right now. I'm not going to direct the whole thing. It's Caleb Carr's The Alienist. Just starting to do the casting part again. It kind of reminded me of when we were doing True Detective, because there's this exciting step in that development process as you start figuring out who are the people who are going to make this come to life. And with each actor, it's a totally different thing, you know. And when you kind of imagine them in these leading roles, it can go in different directions. It changes the way I'd want to write it.
When you work with actors, do you feel, because you seem very sanguine, but when you go on the set now, do you feel intimidated when you have to deal with the crew and the actors, or you feel very confident now?
I think that the first week—
Confident
enough. The first week of shooting is always a bit wobbly as you try to figure out pace, tone, figure out how, you know, to communicate with people you're not comfortable with yet. And what you ultimately want is to get on a good sort of direct line, you know. But you never know what someone's limit is. You don't know with an actor where they're going to get irritated that you're just talking too much. I talked to Chiwetel Ejiofor about this a little bit, about
great actor.
Yeah, amazing actor, and about self-directing. And when you start to do more projects and not getting, especially if you've worked with greats who, you know, when the day is done, you know what you've done, and you don't need to go watch the dailies, and you know what your character is onto next and how to jump in these new scenes, and then you go into something else where you're getting nothing. How do you survive those productions? And that's when you start, this skin gets thicker and you just rely on yourself and—
You get confused too.
Yeah. Well, that's the part. The thicker skin comes from learning not to get that, make that confusion make you feel insecure and affect the performance, especially if you're operating on your own. I think for me, my style at least is, or what I've learned is it's usually about the conversations before we start shooting. And if we're 100% on the same page about who that character is, then every idea that comes out of the actual shooting is a continuation of that conversation. And it's not like you're Hopefully. Just making up direction just to fill the space with more words, you know, between takes. Because there is that stillness I was talking about in Jane Eyre where I learned where I didn't have to say anything because we had talked about beforehand was working. So we can just move on.
I remember when I was going to a friend of mine who was a producer, director, and writer wanted me to do a movie, which was based on the character was a big-ticket NBA basketball coach, and he was friends with Pat Riley. And this is when Riley was coaching the Knicks here in New York, and he took me out to the facility up in New Paltz where the team was training then. And then we got in a car, and we went to Riley's home and had lunch with him. And I said to him, what's the job? What's the task? And he said, I have people who've been dominant in this sport since they were 8 years old. He said they were dominant in their peewee leagues. They were dominant in high school, college. They get into the pros. He said they've been dominating this game and playing thousands of basketball games for nearly two decades. And he goes, and my job is to walk into a room and make them care one more time. How do you make them care enough to go out there? And a lot of directors don't feel that they have that obligation that, you know, you're going to come and you're getting paid all this money or whatever the bullshit is, that, you know, you motivate yourself. And I wouldn't mind if the director came in every now and then and tried to enlist me in the cause and say mm-hmm. something. The last thing I want to say to you is, I mean, again, about Beasts of No Nation is whenever people talk to me about movies and they extol some movie they've seen, I always smile and then I say, well, let's calm down here because the big question is, would you watch the movie again? Mm-hmm. You made an amazing movie.
Thank you.
You made an incredible movie. When that boy goes running into that water, I was sobbing. I was sobbing. And I hope that you'll stick with your instincts because your great instincts have gotten you where you are now. I did a small part in Warren Beatty's movie about Howard Hughes. And I said to him, I said, you know, your problem is you don't make enough movies. You know, you're just too slow. And I'll say the same thing to you. Don't stop making movies. Keep making movies. Don't take too much time off. You know what I mean?
You know, I was supposed to make a movie last year and it sort of fell apart. That sort of mid-range Hollywood $40 million film fell apart just because sometimes you're just not creatively in sync with the money people.
You can watch Beasts of No Nation on Netflix. I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios.